And good evening, everyone, and welcome to Beyond the Matrix. And you may be asking yourselves, what happened to Pat last week? I do apologize to the guest that was supposed to be on, Graham Talbot, but something really remarkable happened to me that I want to share with you, and that is that I went into the pyramid in Egypt, and I thought I was going to be coming out rather quickly, but they let me stay longer. In fact, I had to wait for someone to get me out, and I couldn't get back in time to make the show. So please accept my apologies for abandoning you last weekend, and know that it was for a higher good. So, as I said, welcome to Beyond the Matrix. This is the show that asks you to get out of the box of convention and journey the ever infinite potential of your mind. And who better to talk to us about that tonight than Dr. Mario Beauregard, PhD. He is the author of a wonderful book called The Spiritual Brain, A Neuroscientist Case for the Existence of the Soul, which he has co-authored with Dense O'Leary. I might be pronouncing that wrong. He's a professor at the University of Montreal, where he has focused his research upon the effects of consciousness in the emotional brain and the neurobiology of the mystical experience. And you know this is something that is going to turn me on when we talk about science and spirit uniting. And so, Doctor, are you with us?
Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us. I'm delighted to have you with us. I know it's going to be a very titillating show. And where are you? Where are you in Canada?
In Montreal.
In Montreal. How's the weather there?
Well, it's rather cold today. It's in the mid 40s.
Yeah. Well, let's hope you get the snow is going to slow down a little bit, because I know you've had quite a winter out there.
Yes, ton of snow.
Okay, I've asked you to be on the show because I'm always excited, as I said, to explore the merging of science and spirit. And certainly you have made a remarkable effort to help us understand more how the two coexist. And so I'd like to ask you to start by giving us an overview into your book, which is a big question because it's such an intense book.
Yes.
Let's start with what was your purpose in creating this work?
You mean the trust behind this project, or
yes,
the origin of this book?
Yes.
Well, in current neuroscience, the mainstream view is that mind, consciousness, and also spirituality can be reduced totally to electrical and chemical processes in the brain, and so it's a very materialistic and reductionistic view. And I decided to challenge this view because there are several lines of evidence indicating that this view is not correct. So I explored various lines of evidence, starting with our own findings, the studies we've done with the Carmelite nuns, but also I decided to present other lines of evidence because in the kind of work we're doing, we're using neuroimaging techniques like functional magnetic resonance imaging. It's a form of scanner that allows to visualize which parts of the brain are active during all sorts of tasks.
That would be a CAT scan.
Yes. But we're measuring the changes in terms of oxygen consumption in the blood circulating across the brain. And this phenomenon is coupled to electrical activity in the nerve cells. We also use another technique that is called EEG, or electroencephalography, and it measures electrical activity of the brain. So we have access to all sorts of neuroimaging techniques, and we measure what we call correlates. So correlates are simply biophysical measures of what's going on in the brain during all sorts of tasks. It couldn't be an emotional task. It can be also a spiritual state or experience.
What kind of test do you do?
Pardon me?
What kind of, obviously you must evoke some, you must, when you say emotional or spiritual,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Evoke a thought or emotion in the person?
Oh, yes. So if we study emotion, for instance, we can use emotionally laden pictures, or so static pictures, but it can be also film excerpts to induce a specific emotional reaction. In the case of spirituality and spiritual experiences, we ask the nuns to enter into a state of contemplation and prayer. And because we were interested to see what's going on in the brain during a mystical state, a state of union with God, according to the terminology of the Carmelite nuns. The Carmelites are members of a Roman Catholic order, and this order has been oriented toward mysticism by especially St. Teresa of Avila and also St. John of the Cross during the 16th century. So we did that, and effectively we've been able to measure all sorts of changes, very interesting changes in the brain during this state. And we were testing a specific hypothesis, namely the God spot in the brain, because about 30 years ago, some neurologists reported that when the epileptic seizures are located within this portion of the brain that we call the temporal lobe, sometimes the patient will report a spiritual experience. And so the neurologists concluded that the temporal lobe was the God spot or the God module. But this interpretation was based on a very materialistic explanation of this phenomenon. So they were trying to reduce spiritual experiences to simply misfirings of neurons in this region of the brain. In our
right,
case,
but in fact, it's very interesting that you brought up epilepsy because in many ancient civilizations and indigenous tribes, mm-hmm. people with epilepsy were always revered as the real seers.
Exactly, that's right, because it seems that during these seizures, there's a kind of electrical and chemical shift in the brain, and this shift allows the individual to have access to another form of reality. So in our case, we saw activation in the temporal lobe. It was there, but there were also many other brain regions activated during the mystical state, in particular regions of the brain normally associated with positive emotional states and also self-awareness, because there's a marked change in terms of self-awareness during a mystical experience. And so when you do this kind of study, of course, you measure what I called earlier correlates. So there's no causality involved. In other words, we don't know if the activity that we measure really relates to an external reality, a reality external to the subject of our experimentation, or perhaps it's simply a product of their imagination. So to be able to solve this question, we have to turn toward the near-death experience, because it's a very interesting model for neuroscience, especially in the case of near-death experience that are induced by cardiac arrest. Because when there's a cardiac arrest, the brain was shut down after about between 10 to 15 seconds, because there's no blood circulating anymore. And it's very interesting because in certain surgical procedures, the surgeon will induce a cardiac arrest to be able, for instance, to remove giant aneurysms at the base of the brain in a region that is called the brainstem. The brainstem controls all the vital functions such as heart rhythm and also breathing. And
but why do they induce the cardiac arrest?
Well, because to remove all the tension in the blood system. So by doing this, all the blood is drained from the head, and the body temperature is decreased to about 58 degrees Fahrenheit. And so basically you put the person clinically deaf for a certain period of time. This period ranges between normally 15 to 60 minutes, an hour.
Wow.
And during that time, the person is clinically dead, and the brain is not functioning, and the likelihood of a successful surgery is then much greater for these cases. And about 15 years ago, there was a case of a woman named Pam Reynolds, and she was suffering from such a major aneurysm at the base of her brain, and her life was threatened because these aneurysms can burst at any moment. And she heard of a neurosurgeon in Phoenix, Arizona. His name is Dr. Robert Spesler. And about 30 years ago, Spetzler devised this so-called standstill procedure, during which the heart is stopped and the blood is drained from the head. In her case, she was clinically dead for about 60 minutes. And so it's quite long. And what's fascinating is that while she was clinically dead and that her brain was not functioning anymore, she's had the impression of leaving her physical body and floating above her physical body during the surgery. And she's been able to draw very accurately some of the surgical instruments that were used during the surgery. And also she reported very accurately also some dialogues exchanged between the neurosurgeon, the cardiologist, and also the nurses who were there. And at another step during this experience, she's had the sensation of floating along a tunnel at a very high speed, and at the end of the tunnel, she met with the deceased relatives and friends, and in the last part of her experience, she met with a beautiful being of light, and her life was totally transformed by this experience. And this was the first case that we have where for sure we know that there was no brain activity, and yet the person is able to perceive, to have consciousness, to have emotions. And so it's this case, and now we have other cases like this one. This case directly challenged the mainstream materialist view in neuroscience that mind, consciousness, and spirit are simply byproduct of electrical and chemical processes in the brain.
You're talking about her case, Pam's case.
Yes, but now there are other cases that are coming out. So,
well, in fact, so many people are reporting on these. Even my own mother had she had surgery, and they nicked an artery, and they had to rip her open. And when I flew in from Italy to see her, and she told me that she heard them say, "This is a goner. Let's pull the plug." And she was screaming from inside, "No, no, no! I'm alive. I'm here. Don't abandon me."
Yes.
And they were ready to pull as the proverbial plug. So,
right.
I have a little bit of a first-hand experience here, or at least second-hand.
Well, these cases
my own
are
mother.
Quite common now, but because the techniques of reanimation are much better now than they were 50 years ago or 30 years ago. So there are millions of cases out there. But in terms of neuroscience research, the cardiac arrest paradigm is very interesting because, like I said before, when there's a cardiac arrest, about 10 to 15 seconds after that, the brain will shut down. So it's very powerful for us, very interesting, because if there's no brain activity, mainstream neuroscience tells that there cannot be any consciousness or mind processes going on.
But this disproves that, because when you say the brain shuts
yes.
down in 15 seconds, you're obviously
yes.
not talking about the mind.
Yeah, so it's like if the brain is acting like a kind of transponder of mind and consciousness and spirit at another level.
So can you define the difference between mind and brain?
Well, the brain seems to act like a sort of interface for the mind. And so the mind, of course, is conditioned by the brain in terms of its expression and experience in an healthy person. Because if there's a lesion, for instance, in specific parts of the brain, then the conscious experience and mind processes will be altered. For instance, in the case of Alzheimer's disease. And you have all sorts of disease, like Parkinson's disease. And so you have very specific destruction of nerve cells in those cases. And the destruction of the nerve cells will significantly change, of course, perception and cognition and emotion and the people suffering from those diseases. But it's not because in my view, it's because the relationship between mind and brain is altered. It's like if you're playing in your TV set, for instance, you're playing with the electronics at the base of your TV set, and if you change something, if you twitch something in the electronic system, the components of your TV, of course you will alter the reception of the information. But yet, the TV station keeps emitting, you know, the same kind of programs, but the reception is distorted. And I think we can use the same analogy for the mind-brain relationship.
Mm-hmm. But we're going to get into, I'm just going to announce again your name, and we're going to talk about the God gene. We're talking with Dr. Mario Beauregard, PhD, and his book is The Spiritual Brain. And, Doctor, do you have a website that we can refer people to find out more about your work?
Well, I have a website for my lab at University of Montreal, but it's more for academic purpose.
If people want to buy the
Google,
book, where do they get it? Every bookstore and Amazon,
you
everywhere?
Yeah, you get there, for sure.
Oh, okay. So we go back to now, you talk a lot in the book. I haven't finished the book, by the way, because it's very... it's getting harder and harder for me because I interview someone each week, and this is like being back in the university.
Yeah.
And your book is very, very important and very deep, and so I'm not all the way through. But I do, I'm very fascinated about your discussion of the God gene,
mm-hmm.
and this is a big theme in the book, and I was wondering if you could, I know how hard it is to shrink big concepts into a short interview, but would you like to talk about that, the concept of the God gene?
Yeah, I'll try to simplify the whole matter. A few years ago, there's a molecular geneticist at the NIH, National Institute of Health in the United States. His name is Dean Hammer, and he wrote the God gene. And the book is based on a series of work that he did in the last decade, and what he did essentially is that he discovered that there's a relationship or a correlation, technically, between a specific gene in the body and also certain traits as measured by a scale which explore various aspects of spirituality. So there are various components in the scales that in the scale that are measured, like self-transcendence, for instance, and the sense of interconnection with the environment. And so he discovered that there's a relationship, a statistical relationship between a specific gene, and this gene codes for various chemical messengers in the brain. We call these messengers monoamines, and specifically they refer to serotonin. Serotonin is a chemical messenger that is involved in mood regulation, but it's also involved in spiritual experiences and spirituality. There's also dopamine, which is actively involved in reward and motivation. And there's also another transmitter called noradrenaline, which is involved in arousal and stress. And these chemical messengers are related to the components of the scale I was talking about earlier. And this scale has been devised by Robert Kleininger, a psychiatrist at Washington University in St. Louis. And so this scale measured various aspects related to spirituality. So the problem with this very reductionistic interpretation is that the gene in question simply refer to chemical messengers that are involved in all sorts of functions in addition to spirituality. And we know that for every function, behavioral function, whether they are emotions or cognition, for instance, memory, perception, it's not only one gene selectively that will be involved, but rather thousands of genes and also the interaction between these genes. And so Dean Hammer has been accused of being very reductionistic regarding the question of spirituality in the brain. And a few years after he published his book, he recognized publicly that perhaps he was too radical in his opinion, and he agreed with some of his critics that, of course, thousands of genes are very likely involved in what we call spirituality and also spiritual experiences. And that's the viewpoint that we adopt in the spiritual brain regarding this question.
And would that include some of what of the DNA that's considered junk DNA?
No, no. In his case, he specifically identify a very selective gene, and but he did not refer to junk DNA. But junk DNA must,
junk,
must also
just don't
be
know
involved.
What it's doing, right?
Yes, exactly. And so it must also be involved with what we call spirituality.
I think that it's very exciting to know that as more and more discoveries are made about our gene codes,
mm-hmm.
We're realizing more and more that we have the potential to uncover all of this so-called junk DNA and
right.
learn bit by bit what it serves.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because nothing could be junk in the
no.
the body. That just doesn't
no.
make sense at all.
I agree.
Can you tell us more then about your test with the Carmelite nuns and what you learned from them in those tests?
Yes. Well, like I said before, we were testing the so-called God module or God spot hypothesis in temporal lobe. So we wanted to know if this region was really the soul region involved in a mystical experience. And the results of our studies, both with the fMRI, or functional magnetic resonance imaging technique, and also with EEG, these results indicate that the temporal lobe seemed to be involved. This is true, but it's not the only region. In reality, these mystical states seem to be supported by a complex network of brain regions involving several parts of the brain that are normally associated with various aspects like self-consciousness or self-awareness, also emotion, positive emotion, because there's very often a positive emotional component involved in a mystical experience. There's also a brain region that is called the parietal cortex, which is involved, and this region is normally associated with what we call body representation. This is the representation made at the brain level regarding the location of the physical body within space. And during deep mystical states and also deep meditative states, this representation is altered, and the brain, this brain region, the parietal cortex, of course, is modified in terms of its activity. And so we saw changes, marked changes in this region of the brain. And there's also been a study done by Andrew Newberg at the University of Pennsylvania a few years ago with Buddhist meditators, experienced Buddhist meditators, and Andrew Newberg also noticed a marked change in terms of metabolic activity in the parietal cortex. So this is very interesting. And finally, the nuns were reporting a lot of, they had their eyes closed during the so-called mystical condition, and they were seeing a lot of visual image, mental images, and so we saw activation also in visual portions of the brain, at the back of the brain, while they had their eyes closed. So it seems that this experience is rather complex and involves much more than a single spot in the brain. And also, based on these findings, in terms of EEG, in addition, I would like to add something about this. We saw at the same time a very marked alteration in terms of EEG activity, electrical activity. So there was a very important reduction of brain activity in terms of electrical activity. So we saw a lot of very slow waves, like theta waves and also delta waves, in the brain of the Carmelites during the mystical state. And it's very interesting because theta waves have been observed in various EEG studies of Buddhist monks. And also delta waves, normally they will appear during very deep sleep or in some states of coma. But in the Carmelites, they were fully awake, and yet there was a lot of these those waves present. So if you take all these findings all together, it's clear that in order to have access to another reality, a spiritual reality, you need to induce an electrical and chemical shift in terms of brain functioning relative to the normal state while we are awake. So in other words, you need an alteration, at least a slight alteration of your state of consciousness in order to have access to these other dimensions, if you will.
So what you're saying is that when a person is having a mystical, let's call it a mystical experience for lack of a more precision terminology, a mystical experience, there will be an electromagnetic variation in the brain.
Exactly, yes. But these things can occur very rapidly and very spontaneously. So sometimes the person will seek this type of experience, and in order to reach that state, the person will do some prayer or will contemplate or meditate in a specific way. But at other times, it's possible to experience something of a mystical nature, but it seems that it's spontaneous, so that there's no apparent trigger. But yet, there's an important change in terms of brain activity at those moments. I've received, following the publication of the book, many letters from people all over the world reporting such experiences. And these experiences occurred apparently without any specific reason. But in terms of neurological activity, we know for sure that there was something changed in the brain of the people who experienced these things.
Well, you know, there are a lot of stories about people who have an accident and their lives change completely. They become clairvoyant. Or another thing I'd like to discuss is, since we're talking about electromagnetic intervention, is people who get struck by lightning.
Yes.
And
well, I think that
some of them completely have a completely new capacity and, let's say, processes, mental processes that that I would call third eye activation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you believe in the clairaudience and clairvoyant faculty?
Well, in a certain portion of the brain, we discussed these so-called psi phenomena, and they've been studied for about nearly a century now, and the evidence for these phenomena is overwhelming statistically, and but since they do not fit in the conventional mainstream view in science, they are rejected by several scientists, especially neuroscientists, because if you believe that what you call mind and consciousness and spirit are simply byproducts of electrical and chemical activity in the brain, then of course you cannot be in communication with anything outside of the physical body, and you cannot receive any information. You cannot, emit information also. So you're totally like in prison, in jail, within your body and your brain. But the evidence goes totally against this. So that's why neuroscientists feel very uneasy about those issues, because they do not have any good explanation.
Well, that's why we celebrate you for thinking outside of the box and in your realm, in your academia. I'm sure that it took you a lot of courage to come out with such a controversial approach
not really.
To this deep subject.
Well, no, I'm not courageous. It's because I've experienced these things myself since my childhood. It started when I was about 8 years old. I'm now 45, and so I've had a series of spiritual and psychic experiences throughout my life, and these experiences clearly show me that the mainstream view was totally flawed, and that we needed a new meta paradigm in science, and especially in neuroscience. And so, you know, the evidence are out there, based not only on my own personal experience, but also if you take a look. Clearly and objectively at the literature out there.
Oh, well, it's just wonderful that you exist and you're doing this work. I just want to introduce you again for people that are just tuning in. The book is The Spiritual Brain, and my guest is Dr. Mario Beauregard, PhD, who is talking about the case for the existence of the soul from a neuroscientist point of view. Fascinating conversation, and we will be taking your questions. So if you'd like to ask a question of the doctor, please go to www.bbsradio.com to station 2, where you'll find the telephone numbers that you can call in on. It's a wonderful opportunity to talk to an expert in the field. So what kind of psychic experiences did you have as a child? Or you said you all through your life.
All sorts of experiences, like clairvoyance a lot, and telepathy. And my mother is very psychic and very intuitive, and so a lot of intuition, and I've experienced all the gamut of these experiences.
That's amazing. It's just amazing that you've gone from those experiences, you've been able to bring that into science. I'm just delighted to see that science and spirit are now coming closer and closer together and breaking down all the barriers from both sides.
Yes. But if you take the case of great scientists throughout history, most of these scientists, like Newton and Descartes and Galileo, for instance, they were all very spiritual persons, even Albert Einstein. And
well, sure, so, because there's got to be the inspiration, and the inspiration is spirit.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, I had another question for you that just slipped away. What happened? I've had a number of guests on who have talked about various aspects of hallucinogenic in medications or illicit drugs,
right,
and also spirit journeying with shamans with hallucinogens.
Mm-hmm.
And could you talk to us about what really happens in the brain from a technical point of view when someone uses these hallucinogens, and what is, in your opinion, what is really going on with the visions that come from these journeys, let's call
yes.
them trips?
Well, based on all our findings, and also findings by other research teams and research groups regarding the brain and spirituality, it seems that the brain is acting like a reducing valve. So this is not a new concept, because it's been proposed about 100 years ago by the father of American psychology, William James, and also by Henri Bergson, the French philosopher, and after that by Aldous Huxley, the famous writer. And so this is the idea that normally the brain will function very rapidly, if we take the case of EEG activity. So in terms of electrical activity, you produce a lot of beta waves, or rapid waves, and you are focused on the external environment. And so this means that everything that comes from the inside, which is very internal, very deep, all the information processed at the level of the unconscious and also at the supraconscious level, is not perceived immediately, because we're not in touch with it, because the focus of the attention is directed towards externally. It's directed externally, driven externally. And so I'm coming back to this idea that in order to have access to hidden information, or information coming from very deep within, you know, in terms of your core, in terms of spirit, you need a shift in terms of electrical and chemical activity. If you talk about the brain electrical activity, it means that there will be a slowing down of EEG activity. So you need very slow waves, like a lot of theta waves, for instance, and also even delta waves, the waves I was talking about earlier. And if you have access to this, then you can be more in touch with hidden dimensions that are normally hidden, like what we call the spirit, or the spirit world, or spiritual.
So do you think that a person who's taking an LSD these hallucinations are actually being in touch with other dimensions?
Well, exactly. If you take the case of these drugs, they will target specifically the chemical messenger called serotonin. We talked earlier about this messenger. And serotonin is crucially involved in spirituality and spiritual experiences. So you will have, when you take these drugs, of course, you will have an alteration in terms of perceptual abilities. So there's a lot of distortion that is created, and that's why we talk about an hallucinatory component in these experiences. But it's not the only component and the main component. The most important is the spiritual component. So because in those cases, the brain is not acting anymore as a reducing valve, in a usual sense, then it's possible for the experiencer to have access to other realms. And very often, the experience that are lived under those conditions will be very important, very crucial for the individual, and they will have a very long-term impact on this person. And so I think this is exactly what happens with shamans, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever tested anyone with these that was under the influence of these chemicals?
No, because they are not allowed. Since the this kind
true.
Of research is not possible, or it's very rarely that we can have the permission to do this kind of work since the late 70s, because the after Timothy Leary, the U.S. government decided that it was not possible anymore to do this kind of studies, and
because they were doing them themselves.
Well, yes, it's possible to do that. Actually, I've done some experiences myself with these compounds that some people called entheogens instead of psychedelics, because the emphasis is put on the spiritual dimension when you use the term entheogen instead of the perceptual distortion that I was talking about. And so I tested some of these substances on myself. And since I've had very intense spiritual experiences before without taking these substances, I was able to compare. And I realized that the nature of these experiences can be very similar. And this has been studied in the 60s and beginning of the 70s by some people. And there's a great historian of religion, Houston Smith, for instance. He wrote several books on perennial philosophy and the commonality between all the great spiritual traditions of the world. And in 1962, he was a student, a theology student at Harvard. He participated to a famous experiment called the Good Friday Experiment. And the experimenter was, or the lead scientist was Walter Pahnke. And he gave them psilocybin, mushrooms. And he wanted to compare, they did a comparison between a placebo group and an experimental group. And Houston Smith was a member of the experimental group. And at that time, during this experiment, he had a very intense spiritual experience. And he's now more than 80 years old. And the effects of this experience, this specific experience, lasted for over 50 years. So you see, it's not true that because you will use a chemical means to induce an alteration of the state of consciousness that automatically the experiment or the experience subjectively is not genuine. It's
because the people that were on the placebo still had the effect?
No, they didn't have the...
they didn't have it.
Not at all, because for the placebo effect, this effect is not very long-term. After a few months, usually it will disappear. So, and if you take, if you want to induce an experience, for instance, using other means like prayer or contemplation or meditation, well, the people have to know that when they do that, they automatically induce changes in terms of their own brain activity. So there's always...
Can you elaborate that? Because I think that people really need to hear that.
Yes. Well, you can do all kinds of things, anything. You can, if you breathe on a very regular schedule, for instance, like what they do in the rebirthing or allotropic breath work or stuff like that, or if you pray on a regular basis, you change your brain. Now there are studies, neuroscience studies, coming out showing that if you meditate on a regular basis, then you change even the structure of your brain. So, of course, you change everything inside the brain when you do these activities. You change what's going on electrically, chemically, also in terms of your own structure.
It's like a workout for the brain gym.
Exactly, yes.
All right, now here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
We hear more and more that people who are having transplants of organs, the receiving
yes.
people start to behave very strangely, acquiring personality traits of the people that they've received the organ from. This is recently in the news, a woman.
Yes.
I believe she committed suicide after she got an organ from someone, the heart of someone who had committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
She got the heart and she committed suicide. And there are more and more stories about this that are documented about personality traits, eating habits, etc. I would like you to, from your point of view, describe how you feel that this is being communicated. Let's suggest that it's a heart. Because I believe that the mind is in every cell of every body, of every organ, tissue, etc.
Yes, that's the most likely explanation.
How do you feel about this?
I think that when we refer to mind, for instance, we're speaking in terms of, we should see it as an informational field. And so it's possible that the memories, for instance, of the donor have affected all the organs of her body before she committed suicide. And
sure, because by nature of the creation of body, every cell has a command it responds to. It has a knowledge of what it's supposed to do.
Exactly. And so, for instance, we've done a series of brain imaging studies in our lab showing that it's possible simply by with a very specific intention to change the brain activity chemically or electrically, simply by intention and volition and desire. So, and the neurons, the nerve cells in the brain will respond very specifically to these intentions and desires and emotions. And so it's probably exactly the same kind of phenomenon.
And this, to the layperson, would be the term mind over matter.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So I think one important message we should give the audience that's listening tonight is to, there's so much stress and turmoil at the moment, and a lot of people are getting into fear and lack, and always reminding them that not only from a spiritual point of view, but from a scientific point of view, how they manage their thoughts,
yes,
directly affects how they're going to manifest their reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
It might sound hackneyed, but I think it's a message that we have to keep hearing and hearing and hearing again.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
And so you're saying that with the process of intention and meditation and volition and will,
yes,
they can actually change the entire structure of the brain for a higher purpose.
Yes, and it's even possible that if you do this, then you will also alter gene expression, you know, for specific genes. And so it's not been shown yet, but we suspect that this might indeed be the case. And I'm sure that in the next few years, we'll be able to demonstrate this. And at the same time that you influence what's going on internally in your body physically, you also influence what's going on externally to you, because there's increasing evidence in psych research showing that humans have the capacity mentally to influence electronic systems, biological systems, plants, animals, and other human beings as well. So it's like if we're all interconnected within a sort of unified field, and this field is part of or comprise everything in the cosmos, in the universe. And so
and we're relearning this, because we've been through such a period of separation, an age of what do we call it? Logic, reality. Let's call it logic, reason, the age of reason. And there's a lot of separation in that approach to our existence, and we're relearning how everything is connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yes, totally.
And we have to learn really quickly here.
Yes, of course, yes.
What would you like to bring to the people that are listening to you tonight as one of the most important messages that comes from your work?
Well, I started in neuroscience as an independent researcher about 12 years ago, and since then I've done a series of brain imaging studies, and if you take these studies all together, they all demonstrate that human beings are not biological robots, totally determined by their neurons and by their genes. But to the contrary, like you said before, we have to be very careful in terms of what we think and our own feelings, emotion, and this kind of thing, because they have the power to totally change your brain activity, the functioning of your brain and the physiological systems that are connected with the brain, and also the influence other people and everything that lives on the planet. And so in other words, humans have an enormous power, but they are not aware of this yet collectively. So that would be the take-home message.
And what do you think will? I agree with you completely, and this is probably in my own personal work. This is my biggest message is that you create. I think this is. I'm not even trying to claim this is my own message, but driving home over and over again, you create your reality. Your reality is a reflection of how you what you put out into the environment.
Yes.
Immediate and further, and you take responsibility. I'm a Buddhist. You take responsibility and credit for what you create and responsibility at the same time.
Right.
And that helps you really align your, really understand how you're using thought, your thoughts.
Yes. Yes, because thoughts are very powerful energetically, and so we have to be aware all the time, and we're much greater than what we think we are, really. So
indeed.
But
we need your research. You've got to bring us more research to help the skeptics understand by being able to see what they call in black and white, where you see the patterns of a spiritual experience in someone in your tests, and you see normal processes, and you start to show these patterns, and people can say, wow, look at the difference, or something. We need to help the skeptics get past the doubt and into the light,
yes,
the stream of light
that
we're all working to bring forward for humankind.
Yes, I'm sure it will come during the next decades.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a revolutionary moment very soon now.
Yes.
I do believe we're going to have contact with extraterrestrial intelligence. I think we have it already. I think we're going to see something happening around the globe that's going to be a very important trigger for humankind.
Yeah. Well, you have already some evidence of this with the crop circles all over the world.
Yeah, and that's a great segue, because I just wanted to remind everyone that, again, that I've got a group, I'm bringing a group to the crop circles and sacred sites in July, and there are still spaces available in my group, so get in touch with me if you would like to sit in a crop circle and see what it means to be in a multidimensional space. It's just so remarkable. Yeah, the crop circles. Have you been there, Doctor?
Nope, never. No.
But you gotta go.
It's clear that, you know, there's a... You know, we have to remember that humankind is very young from an evolutionary point of view still, and it's like if we're at kindergarten yet. And so, but there are many other beings out there in the universe in various dimensions trying to help. I'm saying that based on my own experiences.
We've got to meet. So I'm coming to Montreal pretty sure in October next year. May I have the pleasure of meeting you?
Absolutely.
I would love to. I know that it would be a wonderful encounter, and I'm just so enthralled with all that you bring to the table, and as far as your personal experience and your incredible academic and scientific knowledge. And believe it or not, we're almost out of time.
Oh.
How did that fly? That's way too fast. So you've been listening to... Dr. Mario Beauregard, Ph.D., and again, the book is The Spiritual Brain, A Neuroscientist's Case for the Existence of the Soul. It's a fabulous book. I love the back cover. It says, did God create the brain, or does the brain create God? And have you got an answer to that, Dr. Mario?
Well, depends on the point of view. I think if it's true that humans create their own concepts about God, and they've always been doing that for thousands of years, So you see some differences in terms of the great spiritual traditions of the world. But at the same time, I believe that everything that has been created, that is organized physically, needs an intelligent designer at the origin. And well, there's more and more evidence coming from, for instance, cosmology in physics, and showing that there, even the slightest alteration in terms of the constant of physics, if there's an alteration, then you don't end up with planet Earth and physical universe like the kind we have. So it's clear that you have very obvious that you need a very intelligent source at the origin of everything in the universe. So my response is that, well, you can use the term God, if you will, but yes, God has created everything that is physical, and including the brain.
This is one of those subjects that you just can't sign off with, because it's like the question, if the tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it,
but
did it really happen?
Yes, you can have several perspectives about this issue, of course.
Yeah. Well, I will really hope to meet you when I come to Montreal.
Yeah,
and
we'll stay in touch.
Before I say goodbye to you, I just want to remind everyone, lots of programs coming up for my Soul Quest journeys. We've got July with the Crop Circles. I've got Peru still open. I'm starting to plan for Egypt in January, and back to the Mayans with a shamanic journey with the Crystal Skulls in March. So keep your eye on my site, www.SyrianRevelations.net. And again, thank you so much, Dr. Beauregard. It's been a wonderful hour with you. Too fast. Too many questions that still remain. Maybe you can come back again.
Sure. Okay.
Okay, great.
Bye for now.
All right, everyone. That's it for tonight. Please, please, please tell all your friends. Next week I have Dr. Michio Kaku, considered and known to the modern world as the next Einstein. He'll be talking about his new book, Physics of the Impossible. It's a real delight to have him on. Another scientist merging with spirit. And so it's a very important time to be listening into Beyond the Matrix. So I will listen. I will be with you on Sunday night, and thank you for listening in. Good night, Doctor. Good night, everyone. See you on Sunday.